The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 5, Side 2. As for the Oval Office, so far as can be determined, during all of 1946, Lyndon Johnson was in it exactly once, as a member of a delegation of congressmen. In 1947, he may not have been in it even once. As Symington puts it, Johnson was just never part of Truman's inner circle at all. Horace Busby, who joined Johnson's staff late in 1947, noticed that during his first few months on the job, there was not a single message or telephone call from the White House. Not only was Johnson no longer a presidential protege, he no longer possessed even a trace of the aura of an administration insider. He was only a congressman. Even in his earliest days in Congress a decade earlier, he had been more than that. And when, in 1948, an invitation to the Oval Office finally came, it was not the type for which Johnson had hoped. A Johnson suggestion to Truman, written by Busby, for a re-examination of the administration's program of selling war defense plants to private industry, was released to the press, together with a follow-up letter. Shortly after, a few brief paragraphs began clattering out on the wire service tickers, Johnson's office received a telephone call from the White House. The president would like to see Congressman Johnson the following morning at 11:15. Johnson was very excited by the call. The first thing he did was to go out and get his hair cut and his nails manicured, Busby recalls. He purchased a new pair of shoes. Hurrying to Lewis and Thomas Salt's, one of Washington's most prestigious men's clothing stores, he brought back a box full of white shirts. He wasn't buying them all. They were all different styles, and he just wanted to see which was the most suitable. And a dozen presidential neckties. Calling in another young staff member, Warren Woodward, a dapper dresser, he consulted with him over shirts and ties, and then turned to the folding of his white pocket handkerchief. He wanted all 4 points showing. None of this, just a few points for him, Busby says, and precisely aligned, so he spent part of that evening at his desk, folding and refolding the handkerchief, and cursing it when it didn't come right. And the next morning he kept darting out of his inner office to ask Busby and other members of his staff how much time he should leave for the taxi ride to the White House. The president's interest, however, turned out to be not in Johnson's attire, but in his political manners. Returning to his office about noon, Johnson did not enter through the outer office in which his staff members sat, but, using a key, through the door that led directly from the corridor to his inner office. The door between the two offices was open. Johnson silently pushed it closed. "After a while, he buzzed for me," Busby says. And when Busby opened the door, his boss was just an absolute picture of dejection. Truman, Johnson said, had been furious because he had released the letter to the press before it reached the White House. Johnson imitated the president speaking with his lips in a thin line and hardly moving, as the president did when he was angry. He told Busby that Truman had said, "Lyndon, I don't like to read my mail in the newspapers." Johnson told Busby, "He's absolutely right. We didn't let him get the letter before the press had it. We've learned a lesson. We must never do it again." Even in the House of Representatives, he was, during these years of 1945, 1946, and 1947, not gaining but losing ground. The Speaker did what he could for him. Appointments to two prestigious new committees were in Rayburn's power, and he appointed Johnson to both the House and Senate Joint Committee on Atomic Energy and to the House Select Committee on Post-War Military Policy, most of whose other members were either chairmen or ranking members of their own committees. But while Johnson impressed David Lilienthal, the first chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, who called him an able young man, definitely liberal, shrewd, full of savvy, his attempts to carve out a prominent role for himself on these committees resulted merely in resentment from the other, more senior members. On select and joint, as well as regular committees, as in every phase of life in the House of Representatives, seniority was the dominant factor. Ability couldn't circumvent it. Energy couldn't circumvent it. There was only one way to become one of the rulers of the House, to wait. And then in 1946 came two brutal reminders that even waiting was no guarantee. In February 1944, Representative Leonard W. Schutz of Illinois had died, and in November of that year, Warren Magnuson had won a Senate seat. And suddenly only two men, Patrick Henry Drury of Virginia and Carl Vinson, sat between Johnson and the chairmanship of the House Naval Affairs Committee. Johnson had been inching his way toward the big black leather chairman's seat in the middle of the double horseshoe of the committee seats. Now that chair had begun to seem within reach. During the 1940s, no one could have predicted the amazing longevity of Vinson's career in the House. But Congress, stung by criticism of its inefficiency and inability to come to grips with the complexities of the atomic age and the post-war era, had established a bipartisan joint committee to study its own organization. And now, in July 1946, the committee's recommendations were made, and some of them were adopted, including one for the merging of the House Naval Affairs Committee and the House Military Affairs Committee into a single new Armed Services Committee. On this new committee, Vinson would be chairman, but since six Democratic members of military affairs possessed greater seniority than Johnson, he would no longer be third-ranking Democrat. Vinson's health and longevity, and Drury's, suddenly became much less relevant to Lyndon Johnson's future. There were not two Democrats ahead of him now, there were eight. Moreover, in November 1946, for the first time since 1930, the GOP won control of the House. The victory was a potent reminder of the jaws of the seniority trap. Outwaiting or outliving the eight Democrats ahead of him might not help. If, when his turn in the Democratic line finally arrived, the Republicans were the majority, he still wouldn't be chairman. As for the other possibilities for leadership in the body of which Lyndon Johnson had been a member since 1937, Johnson's post-war record was nearly identical with his pre-war record. He introduced one bill that would have an effect outside his own district in 1945, a minor measure never effectively implemented to give veterans priority in purchasing certain surplus goods after the needs of the federal government were provided for. He did not introduce a single piece of national legislation in 1946 or 1947. In 1948, he introduced a bill, whose details were never completely spelled out and for which he did not fight, to amend the Selective Service Act to draft industries as well as men. By the close of his career in the House of Representatives at the end of 1948, the record would be clear. During his more than 11 years as a member of the House, he introduced only four bills that would affect the country as a whole. In fact, since he introduced only three intra-district bills, he introduced only seven bills in all. 20 other representatives entered Congress in January 1937 and were still there at the end of 1948, so that their terms were roughly contemporaneous with his. One, Eugene J. Keogh of Brooklyn, an energetic legislator, who would later be responsible for the so-called Keogh Bill, a pension measure, introduced 169 bills during those 12 years. Three other representatives among those 20 introduced more than 100 bills. Many of the 20 introduced fewer than that, but not one introduced as few as seven. Johnson introduced fewer pieces of legislation than any congressman who served in Congress during the same years as he. As for passage of legislation, the record is little better. Of the seven bills he introduced, two that affected only his district, were signed into law. 12 of the 20 congressmen had more bills signed into law than that. And since the two pieces of Johnson-introduced legislation that became law were bills affecting only his district, during Johnson's more than 11 years as congressman, no bill introduced by him that would have affected the people of the United States as a whole became a law of the United States. His reluctance to fight for others' bills had, moreover, become even more pronounced. He refused to speak out for causes, refused, it sometimes seemed, to speak out on any issue with the exception of military preparedness, refused to take stands, refused to write not only laws but speeches. Was the congressional record crammed month after month, year after year, with speeches delivered by congressmen in their home districts and then revised and extended so that they would be reprinted in the record and thereby create the impression of involvement in national issues? Very few of those speeches were by Lyndon Johnson. Had entire years passed before the war in which he did not insert a single speech in the congressional record? Entire years passed now, 1944, 45, and 47. In regard to real speeches, talks longer than a paragraph or two actually delivered in the House, their paucity was likewise dramatic. During his first 11 years in Congress, he delivered a total of 10 speeches, less than one a year. He refused also to fight in the press on national issues. He refused to fight not only in public, but in private. Helen Gahagan Douglas was a congresswoman herself now, and her earlier impression of Johnson's constant awareness that what he said might be repeated or remembered, even years later, was confirmed. She noticed that at dinner parties, Johnson still talked a lot, but he still seemed never to say anything substantive. She felt she understood those tactics. Lyndon Johnson, Mrs. Douglas says, was looking down a very long road. But he was making no progress along it. Instead, there were continual reminders that he was slipping back. Once his future on Capitol Hill had seemed so bright. He and Warren Magnuson had talked so often about how badly they both wanted to become senators, and they had both assumed that it would be Johnson, with his access to the White House and to campaign funds, who would reach that goal first. But it was Magnuson who was sitting in the upper house. Indeed, during Johnson's years in the House, 9 members had advanced to the Senate, while he remained behind. Johnson had once been the baby of the 21-man Texas delegation and considered to have a bright future on it. When he had been sworn in at the age of 28, in fact, only 2 of the 435 members of the House were younger than he. Now, with his 40th birthday, August 27, 1948, approaching, many members of the Texas delegation were progressing faster toward committee chairmanships or ranking memberships, passing him on the road to substantial power in the House. In a note of irony, there were no fewer than 10 congressmen named Johnson. 7 of them stood higher in the House hierarchy than he. Rayburn's friendship still gave him the aura of an insider, but it was only Rayburn's friendship that did so, and he was getting a little old to still be Sam Rayburn's boy. He no longer possessed any power of his own, and since he could not resist trying to dominate other men, he was constantly being reminded of this. His attempts to act toward his fellow congressmen as he had acted when he had possessed at least a modicum of independent power, the power of giving them campaign contributions or, because of his White House access, administrative favors, aroused only resentment. Says Representative James Van Zandt of Pennsylvania, "When he wanted something, he really went after it. He would say, 'Now, God damn it, Jimmy, I helped you on this. I want you to help me on this.'" And Van Zandt adds, "Johnson kept asking for favors, and he simply didn't have that many to give in return. He tried too hard, much too hard, to trade on what minor help he had given." "You can do those things once or twice," Van Zandt says. "He did them too frequently. People would get irritated." The atmosphere which had surrounded Lyndon Johnson in the Little Congress, and before that at San Marcos, was now deepening around him in the Big Congress. The powerful older men to whom he was so deferential were fond of Lyndon Johnson, as were a few, very few, of his contemporaries, most of them unassertive men such as Van Zandt or a fellow Texas congressman, Robert Pogue. With others, however, there was less fondness. Says another Texas congressman, O.C. Fisher, "He had a way of getting along with the leaders, and he didn't bother much with the small fry. And let me tell you, the small fry didn't mind. They didn't want much to do with him either." Even the admiring Van Zandt says that people were critical of him because he was too ambitious, too forceful, too pushy. Some people didn't like him. In the House dining room, says Representative Wingate Lucas of Fort Worth, "Guys would come in and sit down at a table near where Johnson was sitting. They would greet all their fellow members nearby except him. And he would get up and say, 'Well, Joe, why in hell didn't you speak to me?' Well, they hadn't spoken to him because they didn't like him. They wouldn't put up with him." The situation was summed up in a symbolic gesture, a shrinking away. The old hereditary Johnson habit of grasping a man's lapel with one hand and putting his other arm around the man's shoulders, holding him close while staring into his eyes and talking directly into his face, didn't offend all fellow congressmen, some of whom liked the intimacy of the gesture, but more were offended. They would draw back from his hand, shrug away from his arm. And sometimes, if he didn't take the hint, they would react sharply. At least once when he took a congressman's lapel in his hand, the congressman knocked his hand away. Without at least a modicum of power behind them, his techniques of manipulating men were ineffective and earned him only unpopularity. With increasing frequency, moreover, his fellow members' eyes now betrayed something that to Lyndon Johnson was as unpleasant as dislike. Johnson was always reading men's eyes. He knew when his colleagues didn't even know who he was. And with increasing frequency, that was the case. A new representative, George Smathers of Florida, was sworn in January 1946. When, almost 2 years later, he saw on the wall of Mrs. Douglas's office a big theatrical picture of a shiny-haired fellow, "I asked her who he was." Until that moment, Smathers recalls, "I wasn't even aware of his existence." Though Johnson had never spent much time in the House chamber, had never listened to the speeches of others, he had, at least during his early years in the House, spent a lot of time in the cloakroom. Now he started going to the cloakroom less and less, and Van Zandt understood why. He couldn't work up the enthusiasm anymore. Estelle Harbin, who had known Lyndon Johnson well when he was young, had said that he couldn't stand being just one of a crowd, just could not stand it. Mrs. Douglas, who came to know Lyndon Johnson well now, when he was no longer so young, was to use similar words. "He never spoke in the House, you know, except on rare, rare occasions. He didn't spend much time listening to others in the House. He usually voted and then left the chamber, loping off the floor with that great stride of his, as though he was on some Texas plain. And if he did remain, he looked a picture of boredom, slumped in his chair with his eyes half closed. Then suddenly he'd jump to his feet, nervous, restless as if he couldn't bear it another minute. His days were punctuated with inconsequential but painful reminders of his lack of status and power. Posing for photographic portraits of the committees on which he sat hurt his pride. In the formal portraits of the committees at their daises, he was embarrassingly distant from the chairman. Informal portraits, such as one of the Naval Affairs Committee taken after luncheon with James Forrestal at the Navy Department, were worse. Forrestal and several of his top deputies were seated in the single row of chairs, and officious committee aides made certain that the remaining chairs were occupied by the most senior congressmen. Johnson had to stand behind them, among the less senior congressmen, distinguished from the group only by his height. He couldn't stand being just one of a crowd, but increasingly one of a crowd was what he was. Whenever during these post-war years Johnson attempted to assert his importance, he was only reminded of how little of it he possessed. He was rebuffed even in an attempt to assert his power over one of his committee's young staff members. 30-year-old Bryce N. Harlow did not, in Johnson's opinion, show him sufficient subservience. So in 1947, the congressman attempted, Harlow says, to take me to the Johnson School. During a subcommittee discussion of a bill Harlow had drafted, Johnson suddenly asked him if some minor point had been checked with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. The demand, says Harlow, who already, as congressional liaison during World War II for General George C. Marshall, had earned a reputation as an expert in legislation, was ridiculous. It didn't have to be checked. He told Johnson so and explained the reason. But Johnson turned to Subcommittee Chairman William E. Hess of Ohio and said contemptuously, "Well, Mr. Chairman, I move the bill be tabled until the staff member checks with the RFC and finishes the job he was supposed to do." Harlow made the check as Johnson wanted and said nothing further about it. A tiny, slender man, years later, taking the lectern at a Washington dinner, he would tell the audience, "Don't wait for the rest of me, I'm standing up." Soft-spoken, gentle, and courtly, he may have seemed sufficiently malleable to be a prime candidate for the Johnson School, and the headmaster may have decided that a further lesson was in order. Shortly after the first incident, Harlow wrote some report with a recommendation as to what the subcommittee should do, just a standard report with the recommendation in the usual form, and to his surprise, Johnson requested an executive session. No sooner had the doors been shut than Johnson said, "I want to register a vehement protest against what the staff has done. It's an insult to the committee." "I was astonished," Harlow recalls, "and so was Bill Hess." Hess said, "What's eating you?" Johnson says, "He's telling the committee what to do. He's telling us how to vote." And when Hess pointed out that Harlow had only made a recommendation, as he had been instructed to do, Johnson, his voice heavy with sarcasm, said, "Let's just dissolve the Armed Services Committee, then. Let's just appoint Harlow to represent the Congress of the United States." But Johnson had mistaken Harlow's character. Decades later, when a journalist could write that Harlow is respected to the point of reverence in political Washington, one reason for the respect was that, devoted though he was to Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon, both of whom he served in high-level positions, he insisted on telling them what he believed, not what they wanted to hear. When someone said, "It must take courage to tell a president he's wrong," Harlow replied, "It takes courage not to do it if you know you should. It may hurt you, but if you don't do it, you can't live with yourself. That's an expensive trip." And Johnson also misunderstood Harlow's financial situation. Lyndon would maneuver people into positions of dependency and vulnerability so he could do what he wanted with them. "And he thought he could do that to me, because," Harlow says, "Johnson assumed that, like most staff members, Harlow needed the job." But Johnson didn't know that Harlow could return whenever he wished to the family textbook publishing business, the Harlow Publishing Company in Oklahoma City. After the executive session, when Hess told him in Harlow's recollection, "Now, Bryce, don't you take this personally. I don't want you to get upset over this," Harlow replied by saying that Johnson likes to pick on me, this is the second time, that I will not accept his further acerbity in the committee, and that he was therefore resigning immediately. Hess, knowing how perturbed Carl Vinson would be at the loss of the young staff aide for whose opinion the former chairman, and still ranking Democrat on the committee, had already developed great respect, he would promote him to chief clerk of the committee when the Democrats regained control of the House, telephoned the admiral, who came to Harlow's office and attempted to persuade him to stay. And when Harlow refused, saying, "You listened to that, you saw what happened," Vinson took him by the arm, said, "All right, you come with me now, we're going over to see Lyndon," and holding on to his arm, brought him over to the Speaker's lobby, sat him down, and summoned Johnson off the floor. He told Johnson to sit down, too, And then, sitting down himself between the two men, Vincent said, "Now, Lyndon, you put on quite a show this morning, and now Bryce is going to quit." The Admiral turned to Johnson and said, "We can't have that. So you're going to tell him you're not going to do that anymore." For an instant, Harlow recalls, he thought Johnson would refuse. But then he looked at Carl and he said, "Oh, hell, forget it. Forget it. We'll get along all right. Don't you worry about it." Johnson made the apology so swiftly and smoothly that it scarcely seemed like an apology. That was what it was. Lyndon Johnson had been made to humble himself before a staff assistant. Reminders of his lack of power darkened even his social life. While he had been stuck on the same rung of the Washington ladder, other members of the little circle of ambitious young men had been climbing, some to impressive heights. He had helped Tom Clark get his first job. Tom Clark was now Attorney General of the United States. Abe Fortas had been only an SEC staffer when they met, and then Undersecretary of the Interior. But in 1946, Fortas formed a law firm with Thurman Arnold and Paul Porter, and that firm became a power unto itself in Washington. Even Mrs. Douglas, so admiring of Lyndon Johnson, says that after Abe got his law firm, Lyndon Johnson was nowhere compared to Abe Fortas. Because of the force of Johnson's personality, his charm, and the respect in which he was held for his political acumen, Lyndon Johnson was still very much a part of the circle, as popular as ever, still missed when he was away in Texas. Yet it was noticeable that the center of gravity in the group was shifting somewhat. Fortas, for example, held forth at length, more now than previously, Mrs. Douglas says. Johnson had always had the habit of falling asleep at dinner parties if he was not the center of attention, putting his chin down on his chest when someone else began to talk, closing his eyes and dozing off for as long as 20 minutes before he woke up talking. He was going to sleep, or pretending to go to sleep, quite often now. When he gave parties in the Johnson home on 30th Place, the guest list was usually impressive, and the guests truly liked him. He made them like him. But as his friends could see, some of the guests were there primarily because they knew that Sam Rayburn would be there, and sometimes this unpleasant fact was rather obvious to the host. There were humiliations even back in his own district, even in matters so minor as office space. Instead of procuring space in a private building in Austin, Johnson had begun demanding offices in the United States Courthouse. Judges and District Attorney Jack Roberts had objected, saying that they were already cramped, but Johnson had gone over their heads to Attorney General Tom Clark, who had discreetly arranged for him to use a two-room suite when district court was not in session. But when, in 1946, Johnson had his name and title painted on the door of the office he had been loaned, he went too far. Needing the room for his own staff, the district attorney ordered the custodian to scrape off the lettering. Subsequently, as Baxter Taylor, Jr., a real estate officer of the Federal Public Buildings Administration, reported to his superior, Mr. Johnson visited the office, discovered the removal, and objected most vehemently. The enraged congressman telephoned John L. Nagel, the building administration's deputy commissioner for real estate management, but Nagel only referred the matter to Taylor, who, after a delay of some months, reported, "There is no space in the building for Mr. Johnson's use." Johnson was forced to ask Clark for help, and Clark secured an office for him in the Travis County Courthouse instead, but only after more bureaucratic delays, to each of which Johnson reacted with a rage that masked his sense of humiliation over the incident, which had become widely known, and a source of amusement, in Austin. In 1946, moreover, Johnson, who had not encountered serious opposition in his four previous re-election campaigns, was opposed by Austin resident Hardy Hollers. Hollers was a respected attorney, but a political neophyte without even a semblance of a campaign organization. He was running against an incumbent who had compiled a spectacular record of improving the lives of his district's impoverished farmers and ranchers with giant rural electrification projects and implementation of other New Deal programs, and whose flooding of the district with federal installations such as the giant Bergstrom Air Force Base and federally financed bodies such as the dam-building Lower Colorado River Authority meant that a staggeringly high percentage of its voters relied on a federal paycheck, and who had created a political machine that was also probably without equal in any other congressional district in Texas. Johnson's margin, while large, he received 42,980 votes, 68% of the vote, to 17,782 for Hollers and 2,468 for a third candidate, Charles E. King, was less impressive when viewed against the tendency of Texas voters to routinely return incumbent senators and congressmen to office. and against the fact that the only district-wide daily newspaper, Charles Marsh's Austin American Statesman, had the tone of a Johnson campaign brochure. Political observers were, in fact, rather startled by both the size of the anti-Johnson vote and by the bitterness against the congressman that surfaced during the campaign. More significant was the reason for the bitterness. Hollers called his campaign a crusade against corruption in public office, and its focus was Johnson's finances and ethics. Johnson, Hollers charged, had enriched himself in office, and had enriched his friends as well, during a time in which other men in the 10th Congressional District had been off at war. He noted that Johnson's three senior advisors, Wirtz, Clark, and Looney, represented the oil companies and the big private utilities Johnson claimed he was opposing. The name of Brown and Root was raised, and for the first time publicly linked with Johnson's. The congressman, Hollers said, was an errand boy for war-rich contractors. If the United States attorney was on the job, Lyndon Johnson would be in the federal penitentiary instead of in the Congress, Hollers said. Will Lyndon Johnson explain how the charter for KTBC, owned by Mrs. Johnson, was obtained? Will Lyndon Johnson explain his mushrooming personal fortune? Johnson's vigorous contention that he played no role in the affairs of his wife's station was not convincing in a small city in which the link between KTBC's advertising and the congressman was an open secret among the city's businessmen. As an Austin journalist was to write, "Never again after this campaign was Johnson free from the belief that he used his public power to get money for himself." Lady Bird was aware of the effect of the 1946 campaign. "That was a watershed," she was to say. "It was the first time we had ugly things said about us. We ceased to be the young, shining knight." And her husband was aware also, even if the subject was a source of pain to him. Once he asked Ed Clark the reason that he was not more loved in the district for which he had done so much. "That's simple," Clark said with his customary candor. "You got rich in office." Johnson leaped to his feet without a word and strode from Clark's office. The fact that one out of every three voters had opposed him, in a district to which he had brought such great economic benefits, preyed upon his mind so incessantly that he could not stop talking about it. "He simply could not understand how any of them came to oppose him," a friend would recall. "He wanted, needed, from his constituents not merely support but affection, and never again was he able to make himself believe that he had it." Adding to Johnson's anxiety during these years was another consideration, one which at times seemed to loom before him more ominously than any other. According to family lore, Johnson men had weak hearts and died young. All during his youth, Lyndon had heard relatives saying that. Then, while he was still in college and his father was only in his early 50s, his father's heart had begun to fail, and Sam Ely Johnson had died in 1937, 12 days after his 60th birthday. Sam Ely had two brothers, George and Tom Johnson. George, the youngest of the three brothers, suffered a massive heart attack in 1939 and died a few months later at the age of 57. In 1946, at the age of 65, Tom suffered a heart attack, and in 1947 he had a second. Lyndon Johnson, who had always been deeply aware of his remarkable physical similarity to his tall, gawky, big-eared, big-nosed father, was convinced to what one of his secretaries calls the point of obsession, that he had inherited the family legacy. "I'm not going to live to be but 60, he would say. "My daddy died at 60. My uncle..." He had no patience with attempts to argue him out of this belief. Once, when Lady Bird was trying to reassure him that he would not die young, he looked at her scornfully and said flatly, "It's a lead pipe cinch." The long, slow path to power in the House might be the only one open to him, but it was not a path feasible for him to follow. Whenever it was suggested that he might make his career in the House of Representatives, he would reply in a low voice, "Too slow. Too slow." Rayburn had begun trudging along that path early. He'd been only 30 years old when first elected to Congress in 1912, and it had taken him 25 years until 1937 to become majority leader. He had not become speaker until 1940, at the age of 58. But Sam Johnson had died at the age of 60. And what if the Democrats should not be in control of the House when Johnson's chance came? The path to power in the House, the silence, the obeisance, was not too narrow for Lyndon Johnson, who could follow sure-footedly the narrowest political road, but it was too long. He had managed to break the trap of the hill country. He might not be able to escape the trap of the seniority system before he died. There was, moreover, another point of comparison with his father, one about which he spoke with his brother, and perhaps only with his brother. Sam Ely Johnson had never been able to recover from the single great mistake he had made. the payment of that ruinously high price for the Johnson Ranch. Lyndon Johnson had made one mistake in that 1941 Senate race. Was he, too, never to be able to recover? Was he never to get a chance to come back? His early rise had been so fast. Now his career had been stalled. He had been stuck in the House for 9 years, and then 10 and 11. He talked endlessly about his fate, about the election that had been stolen from him, about the bad advice he had received not to contest that election because he would soon get another opportunity, about the war that had prevented him from using that opportunity, about the ingratitude of the young men who had not, upon their return from the war, rejoined his organization. And worse, in the words of one aide, much worse, were the times when he wasn't complaining, when, alone with only one or two aides, his voice getting very low, he would talk dispassionately, almost without emotion, about his chances of advancing in his political career, about his chances of advancing in the House of Representatives, in which he had now spent so many years, the House to which he had come when he was young, and in which he was trapped, no longer young. Too slow, too slow. Horace Busby says he was 39 years old. He believed, and he believed it really quite sincerely, that when a man reached 40, it was all over. And he was going to be 40 in 1948, and there was no bill ever passed by Congress that bore his name. He had done very little in his life. The 1941 operation for the gynecological problem that may have caused Mrs. Johnson's 3 miscarriages had apparently not been successful. The sadness the couple felt over their lack of children continued. Then, in 1943, at the age of 30, Mrs. Johnson conceived again. The child, born on March 19, 1944, in the 10th year of her marriage, was a daughter named Linda Bird, in a combination of the father's first name and the second part of Lady Bird. At the hospital, Johnson telephoned Sam Rayburn and Carl Vinson with the news, and then his mother. Lady Bird had had a difficult time in labor, and her doctor had suggested she have no more children, but the Johnsons continued trying. On the morning of June 13, 1945, Mrs. Johnson awoke in intense pain and with a high fever. But Johnson was to recall, she insisted that it was all right for me to go to the office. The minute that I left the room, she called the doctor. A friend from Austin, Virginia Wilkie English, was staying with them, and Mrs. English recalls, before the ambulance arrived, she started hemorrhaging just very, very badly. As Lady Bird Johnson was being carried out the door on the stretcher, however, she made the men stop so that she could give Mrs. English some instructions. There was a manila envelope that was addressed to Jesse Kellum, Mrs. English recalls, and it took 34 cents worth of postage, and I was to put that on and to mail it that day. It had to go out that day. And, Lady Bird continued, she had invited guests to a dinner party the following evening. Mr. Rayburn was coming, and 2 other guests, and the party was not to be canceled. There would be no problem, she said. Their maid, Zephyr Wright, could take care of Linda Bird, and could cook the dinner, and Mrs. English should act as hostess. There's no use to cancel it, because Lyndon has to eat anyway, and they're all invited, Lady Bird explained. Says Mrs. English, man, I couldn't believe that. At Doctor's Hospital, where her illness was diagnosed as a fallopian or tubular pregnancy, Mrs. Johnson's temperature reached 105 degrees. Blood transfusions were needed. Her condition was listed as critical, but after an operation she recovered, although when she returned home, she was forbidden for some time to walk down the stairs. In 1946, Mrs. Johnson became pregnant again, and on July 2, 1947, Lucy Baines Johnson was born. Johnson was later to joke that the 2 daughters were given the same initials as he and his wife because it's cheaper this way, because we can all use the same luggage. But to an aide with whom he was as intimate as he was with Horace Busby, he would be more frank. FDR, LBJ. FDR, LBJ, he told his young assistant. Do you get it? What I want is for them to start thinking of me in terms of initials. He was just so determined that someday he would be known as LBJ, Busby explained. His moods soared and sank, but when they sank now, they seemed to sink lower and to last longer. The years 1946 and 1947, 1947 when Lyndon Johnson marked 10 years in the House, which he had been anxious to leave almost from the day he got there, were filled with periods of deepening depression. With his younger aides, for whom it was important that he be the confident leader in whom they could safely repose their own confidence, he wore a mask of self-assurance. The people who knew him better were worried about him. He lost some of his drive, periodically pausing in the middle of his still-crowded workday to stare out the window with a troubled look in his eyes, his brother was to write. He might spend a half hour that way. Then he would suddenly busy himself with paperwork and long phone calls, driving himself and his staff as never before. A severe eczema-like rash on his hands, always a sign of tension and unhappiness, had bothered him intermittently for years. Now it returned and remained, making his fingers terribly dry, scaly, and painful. Doctors prescribed various ointments, and he often had parts of his fingers wrapped in gauze, but to little effect. Lubriderm, a purple-colored salve, brought temporary relief, and Johnson often kept a bowl of it on his desk and would continually dip his hands into it. The rash was particularly annoying when he was signing his mail, because the edges of papers made little slits in the dry, raw skin, and even a drop or two of blood could mess up a letter. Gene Latimer, who returned to work for Johnson in May 1946, would see him driving himself late at night, signing mountains of letters with his right hand frequently wrapped in a hand towel to keep blood from dripping. Latimer said the rash made him suffer with each signature. But when Latimer begged his adored chief to stop signing, Johnson just shook his head. The signing routine seemed to soothe him, Latimer felt, as if thinking about the mail, he was able for a while to stop thinking about his larger problems. Johnson was smoking more and more, 3 packs a day. He seemed now always to be holding a cigarette, and his fingers were stained yellow with nicotine. Sometimes, lighting a fresh cigarette, he bent over, head low as he took his first puff, inhaled deeply, really sucking it in, an aide says, and sat like that, head bowed, cigarette still in his mouth, for a long minute, as if to allow the soothing smoke to penetrate as deeply as possible into his body. These years were punctuated, as were other periods of crisis throughout his life, by sickness. Just after New Year's Day in 1946, for example, he was hospitalized in Austin's Seton Infirmary. His illness was variously referred to in the press and in letters to constituents as flu or pneumonia, and some of his symptoms were consistent with these diagnoses. Other symptoms, however, were not. Asked about Johnson's hospitalization, 2 aides used the term nervous exhaustion. Walter Jenkins said also it was bad. No one is willing to describe the illness in detail. Whatever its nature, recovery was not rapid. On January 19th, Johnson's aides were responding to inquiries by saying that he hopes to return to Washington almost any day now, and was still in Texas only because of an inability to obtain train or plane reservations. He was still in Seton Infirmary a week later, however, and when, after almost a month in the hospital, he returned to Washington, he was confined to his bed in his house there. On February 7th, he wrote his cousin Oriole that, "I am still having trouble with my throat," and was undergoing a new round of tests at a hospital. On February 12th, he was still ill. In March, he was hospitalized for one of his recurrent painful attacks of kidney stones, and in October, he spent another 3 weeks in the Seton Infirmary and then in the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, for a bronchial infection, the third time he was hospitalized that year. Another Senate election would be held in Texas in 1948. An election in which he, Lyndon Johnson, would be a long shot, not only against the incumbent, Pappy O'Daniel, but against any one of a number of candidates who had statewide reputations, for if his 1941 campaign had brought him recognition across the entire state, the intervening 7 years had largely erased it. His name was little known to the electorate outside his own district. And he wouldn't have Roosevelt's name behind him this time. His chances of winning a 1948 election were not good. Moreover, while the 1941 campaign had been a special election to fill the seat opened by Morris Shepherd's death, 1948 would be a regular election. Texas law prohibited a candidate from running for 2 offices in the same election. To run for the Senate, he would have to relinquish his House seat, and if he lost the Senate election, he might not be able to take the 10th District seat back from his successor. And would he even want to return to the House? If he returned, it would be without even the seniority he had accumulated. And why would he want to return even with seniority? The House held nothing for him. Too slow. Too slow. If he lost in a race for the Senate in 1948, he might well be out of politics, the politics which were his life, forever. He could hardly bear to take the chance to risk so much on a single throw of the dice. At first, he was to tell biographer Doris Kearns, "I just could not bear the thought of losing everything." But what choice did he have? Other public officials in Washington would not take such a risk if taking it meant they might, should they lose, have to leave Washington. Other congressmen and senators talked of how they were anxious not to return to the towns or cities from which they had come because they would miss the excitement and glamour of Washington or the ability to be at the center of things. But it wasn't the excitement or glamour that Lyndon Johnson most wanted, that Lyndon Johnson needed, that Lyndon Johnson had to have. It was power. To stay on in Washington without it was intolerable to him. And since power, substantial power, was not possible for him in the House, he had no choice, really. He had to try for the Senate. However great the sacrifice he might have to make, the sacrifice of his House seat, to enter the Senate race, however long the odds against him in that race might be, he had to enter. To his young aides, and to the young supporters like John Connolly and J.J. Jake Pickle, who were not his aides but whom he would need, he maintained a pose of indecision. But to the men he depended on most and who would guide his campaign, Herman and George Brown, Alvin Wirtz, Ed Clark, he said that he would try once more, that he would make another run for the Senate in 1948. If he lost, he told them, he would not attempt to re-enter politics. After almost 20 years, after so much effort and striving, his career had boiled down to one last chance. For a time, late in 1947, after he had made his decision, that chance appeared to brighten. During that year, Pappy O'Daniel's popularity had been rapidly eroding because of his buffoonery on the Senate floor and because of reports of his profiteering in Washington real estate, and it was becoming apparent that O'Daniel was deciding not to run again. But then came rumors, confirmed in an announcement on New Year's Day, 1948, that Coke Stevenson, a former governor of Texas who 2 years before had retired from office and presumably from public life, would enter the race. O'Daniel was one of the greatest vote-getters in the history of Texas. Coke Stevenson was a much greater vote-getter, by far the most popular governor in the history of Texas, a public official, moreover, who had risen above politics to become a legend. Part 2. The Old and the New. Chapter 8. The story of Coke Stevenson. In all the vast and empty hill country, there was no more deserted area than the 70 miles of rolling hills and towering limestone cliffs between Brady and Junction, about 80 miles west of Johnson City. Only a few widely scattered ranch houses dotted that area. For long stretches after nightfall, not a single light marked a human presence. Beginning in the year 1904, however, there was one light. It was the light of a campfire. Each night it was in a different location, for it marked the camp of a wagon traveling each week back and forth between Brady and Junction. Lying in the little circle of flickering light cast by the fire was a single person, a slender teenage boy, who would be lying beside the fire on his stomach, reading a book. The boy was the son of impoverished parents. He was determined to be something more, and his determination had led him to haul freight between Junction and Brady. Older men, deterred by the loneliness of 5 nights alone each week in the trackless hills, and by the 7 dangerous, often impassable streams that would have to be forded on each trip, had refused even to try to do that. But the boy had tried and had succeeded. The little freight line was beginning to pay. Yet he was determined to be something more. He wanted a profession, and had written away to a correspondence school for textbooks on bookkeeping, and at night he would be studying them in the little circle of light from his campfire. The boy was Coke Robert Stevenson, and if that scene, the single circle of light in the dark and empty hills, the boy within that circle studying to get ahead, the courage and ambition which had brought the boy out into the emptiness, symbolizes the legend of the West, so indeed Coke Stevenson's whole life was the raw material out of which that legend is made. His father was an itinerant schoolteacher who would travel with his family, Coke, born in 1888, was the oldest of 8 children, to remote communities on the Texas frontier and offer to hold a term of school, usually about 3 months, for $30 a month. This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.